Welcome. This is the Gospel of John, an online Bible study with Dr. Harold Attridge.
Okay, we're up and running. So tonight we're going to be looking at the Last Supper and the Farewell Discourse, or Discourses. We'll have to talk a little bit about that issue as we get into it. Just to recall where we were last week and how we're getting into the thing tonight, the narrative flow started at the beginning of chapter 11. When Jesus heard of Lazarus's illness. And at that point, there was a verse that pointed forward to chapter 12. They note that Mary anointed the feet of Jesus, anticipating the story that we get in chapter 12. Then we had the encounter with Martha and the encounter with Mary, a nice little diptych. And then we had the raising of Lazarus himself and the reactions, another little diptych. So the diptych principle, or the balanced episode principle, seems to have been operative through chapter 11, and we've seen that on numerous occasions throughout the gospel. Then we have a little bit of a transition, and then the story about Mary anointing the feet of Jesus. And as I was suggesting last time, basically what we have here, I think, is a Johannine version of the same contrast that Luke used between Martha and Mary, even though there's something positive to be said about each one. What we have here is Martha recognizing the significance of the coming death of Jesus, and the whole of the gospel is pointing toward that. So this is just a reminder that in the last episode that we were looking at, celebrating this sign of the resurrection of Lazarus, there's also this strong pointer toward the passion, toward the cross. And that should be a hint at what's going to be coming today. So after the events in Bethany and the raising of Lazarus, things develop in Jerusalem. And the crowds react to the raising of Lazarus, and the high priests and their cohort plot against Jesus. This is all very much in Johannine language and picking up the momentum of the narrative as it's been built into chapter 11. And then Jesus enters into Jerusalem. And this scene is familiar because the elements of it are stuff that we have heard in the Synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of Mark and the parallels in Matthew and in Luke. And there's a scripture, pair of scripture texts that are cited, Psalm 118 and Zechariah 9. All of this is familiar stuff. So John has picked up something from whatever source he's using, I think the Synoptics, and framed it with the material about Lazarus that has come from the previous episode. And then the crowds react to what? To the raising of Lazarus, and the Pharisees continue their plotting. So we have a nice little framing device here around the entry scene with its familiar notes. And the note that Jesus is coming as king? Ooh, well, we're going to need to think about that in due course. Then we get another little diptych, if you will, with some particular Johannine themes. In chapter 12, verse 20 and following, we have the Greeks seek Jesus. And Jesus declares, when he hears that the Greeks are seeking him, the hour for his glorification has come. The notion that the time of the Passion is the hour of Jesus is not new. This is something that comes to John through his tradition, probably from Mark. We find it in Mark 14:41. But John builds it in a major way. We've seen him referring to it ever since the Cana episode, where Jesus was talking about his hour not yet coming. But now it's come. And why has it come? Because Greeks have come into the picture. And who are these Greeks? Are they Greek-speaking Jews who are coming to Jerusalem to worship for the Passover? Or are they Greeks who are outside of the realm of Israel? Are they proselytes? Are they folk who are not part of the traditional worship of Israel? Not entirely clear. And it's probably another one of these cases where there are multiple meanings involved. In terms of the narrative setting, it would make sense to talk about Greek-speaking Jews coming to the Paschal festivities. In terms of the overall trajectory of the Johannine narrative, we're going out to the world as the hour comes. And so when the Greeks are there, the hour has come. The other part of this diptych is Jesus at prayer. And it's interesting that in the Gospel of John, there is no story of the Gethsemane event of Jesus in agony. But Jesus tells us when he begins this prayer that he's troubled. And many people see here an echo of the Gethsemane story put into a Johannine framework. In any case, Jesus prays and prays a psalm, Psalm 6, verses 4 and 5. And the Father answers. There's a voice from heaven, as there is in Gethsemane and as there is in the Transfiguration, in all of these scenes where there's some sort of epiphany of the divine will over Jesus. It's here at this moment as the hour is dawning that the Father speaks. Jesus asks the Father to glorify his name. This theme of glory comes up again, and we're going to talk about that just a little bit more. This recalls the name theme, too, that we saw in chapter 8, where Jesus declares himself, I am, echoing the various forms of the divine name, especially in Exodus, but also in Isaiah. And it also anticipates the reference to the divine name that we're going to get in chapter 17, the final prayer of Jesus, which kind of frames the whole business of the Last Supper and the farewell discourse. So we have one of these themes that run through the gospel. There were so many themes that run through the gospel, and they achieve a certain prominence in some place. But in each location where they do appear, there's some sort of connection with the way in which the theme has been deployed before. And so Jesus, having presented himself as the divine name, now presents himself in the moment of glorification as the name in a very special sense. But what is the name and what does it convey? One can ask. And that's, I think, where the gospel is trying to push us. What is it that Jesus is conveying in this moment of his hour, when the hour has come, the hour of glory? In any case, there does seem to be some, casual allusion to the agony scene that we have in the Synoptic Gospels, but Jesus is not sweating bloody sweat, as he is, at least in some texts of the Gospel of Luke. Another little diptych, the crowds question Jesus about the Son of Man, since the term has come up. And Jesus, usually, as we've often seen in the Gospel, responds in a way that doesn't quite fit the question, right? He's always pushing people out of their comfort zone, and the comfort zone might be defined by the language that they're using. And here he echoes another one of these themes that has been so prominent in the last several chapters, ever since chapter 8, but had already been anticipated back in the prologue, that he is the light. And he tells people, you want to know about the Son of Man? Well, walk in the light. So where is this light, and how do we find it, and what does it do to us? We get a kind of ironic reaction to what might be our question at that point in the next little episode, the second part of this little diptych, in chapter 12, verses 37 and following, where Jesus interprets a text from the prophet Isaiah about the hardening of hearts and the like. And at the end of that, Jesus cries out that I am the light. The citation of this text and the way in which Jesus frames what he's talking about here in terms of the motif of the light, I think is quite interesting. The text talks about blinding and hardening of hearts. And who is doing the blinding and hardening of hearts? One might think it is God who does so. And if one thinks so, then one would come to a highly determinist view of what's going on in the fourth gospel. People are destined to believe or not believe. And as I think I've suggested a time or two before, I don't think that quite works. I think there's a realm where human decision is required in reaction to the invitation to be in relationship to God through Christ. And I think John recognizes that. So, what is he doing with this quote? The he who's doing the blinding is not God, but the referent of that pronoun is the one who is speaking, and that is Jesus. Jesus is doing the blinding of hearts and hardening of hearts. And how does he do it? Why? By being the light. by shining so brightly in the eyes of people that they turn away. Why do they turn away? Because they don't want to see the light. It's up to them. They loved human honor rather than the glory that stands in front of them, is the answer, Johanna answer to the question of why it is that some people believe and some people do not. It's their responsibility. It's not divine determination. So I think it's a mistake to read a kind of strict Calvinist set of presuppositions into John. John is playing with these categories. He knows the debates about divine determination or divine sovereignty and human freedom. And he comes down on the side of human freedom and responsibility. But he knows that people are reacting negatively to Jesus as well as positively. And it's Jesus, therefore, making possible that decision or making it required that leads to the blindness that some have. To drive the point home and also to raise yet another paradox, we have the Jesus affirming that he judges no one. So he's not in the position of determining the outcome of the confrontation between himself and humankind. That's up to people. He does not judge. It's their actions that produce judgment. Their own decision does so. So this little episode, I think, is a very important one for some of the theological concerns that are on the table or in the periphery around the fourth gospel and what it's doing with its notions of grace, of prevenient grace, to use an anachronistic term, and of human freedom in response to that grace. So this is all chapter 12, setting up the scene for what happens next, and that is the Last Supper. But this chapter pushes in a very strong way the theme of glory. And I think we need to review that just a little bit to remind ourselves of the paradoxical claim that John is making, that the paschal event, the death, the horrible death of Jesus on the cross, is actually a moment of glorification. Remember, we've seen from the prologue the notion that those who hear this gospel and believe it have seen the glory of God. And we know that the Spirit is not yet given, according to chapter 7, since Jesus has not been glorified. So the glorification of Jesus is the necessary condition for the infusion of the Spirit, which will happen a little later on in the gospel, that makes people into brings people into a relationship with God and Christ. Jesus had affirmed in the middle of his declaration about his being the divine name, that culminates in that declaration, that he does not glorify himself. The Father does. And how does the Father glorify Jesus, one might ask? In any case, the theme is there. And the whole business about the raising of Lazarus was there so that the Son of God, Son of Man, and the Son of God might be glorified. So glorification has been a theme that has been pushed throughout the gospel. And those are just some of the episodes where it appears. It also appears in connection with the evocation of the suffering servant passage in Isaiah 53, where the servant will be exalted and lifted up. Exalted or glorified is the Greek term, and lifted up, the term that John also uses in many places, beginning with the allusion to the serpent on the staff of Moses in chapter 3, who is lifted up and seen by people to bring them healing, and in connection with the initial hint at the divine name in chapter 8, 28, that when he's lifted up, says Jesus, people will know that it is I, or that I am. And in chapter 12, the material we just skimmed over, he echoed that theme again. If I'm lifted up, I will draw all to myself. Ah, the Greeks have come. Ah, I'm being lifted up. I'm drawing people to myself. Yes, it's all happening, right? And in John 12, 34, the Son of Man must be lifted up. So being lifted up is to be glorified, to be seen in the way that transforms human existence. Why does it transform human existence? Because it involves the glory of God. And here John is evoking the Old Testament motif of the divine glory, which we find in Exodus, The devouring fire on the mountain is an apparition of majestic, awe-inspiring power, and that's what the glory of God is. It's a fire that melts mountains, according to the Psalms 29 and Psalm 97. The glory of God in the Old Testament is something that is hidden, but also revealed, hinting at what goes on in the use of the motif here as applied to the Passion of Christ. Hidden yet revealed. How does it get revealed? Sure enough, it's hidden, all right. Doesn't look very glorious at all to be hanging on a cross and bleeding and suffocating to death. But the notion that the glory of God is hidden yet revealed, we find in the Old Testament in Exodus, where the glory is in the tabernacle behind a cloud. But we know it's there. Why? Because the word of God has let us know. Or Ezekiel, who sees a mysterious human figure, the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. So one gets to the glory of God secondhand in the vision of Ezekiel. And Ezekiel has the notion that the glory returns to the temple when God's promises are fulfilled. God's presence is in a renewed temple. And yeah, indeed, we know that John has the notion that Jesus is in some sense the renewed temple. We know that from the cleansing of the temple episode, right? And according to Isaiah, the glory of God is revealed by the servant of God. And that's certainly what John has been up to or is going to be up to and what happens in the Last Supper. So I think John has meditated long and hard on the theme of the divine glory as it pops up throughout the Hebrew Bible, and uses it in probably inspired by the passage in Isaiah as a way of talking about the servant and what the significance of his death is, the moment when the glory of God is somehow revealed, hidden but revealed. Okay, so all of this is important for what's going on in the Last Supper and the farewell discourses, and eventually in the Passion story itself. One other little dimension that is going to be influential in the way in which the glory motif is intertwined with other things in the farewell discourses is the apocalyptic use of this terminology, that is, the use in texts about revelations about God's will for the end time and for the restoration of justice and peace and all things good on the face of the planet. Apocalypses celebrate God's glorious coming. Apocalypses like First Enoch from the second century BC, which talks about all the unrighteous falling before the glory of God. We're going to see a little episode of that in the Garden of Gethsemane. And First Enoch in the Parables of Enoch, probably written later than the second century, maybe as late as the first century CE, has the Messiah sitting on the throne of glory. The throne of glory, familiar from Ezekiel, as we've already seen. At the end of the first century, roughly contemporary with the fourth gospel, there were several apocalypses written, reacting to the destruction of the temple of Jerusalem and wondering and trying to explain how God's will is going to be possible after that horrible event, and what the future of Israel might be. One of these texts is Fourth Ezra. And talks about the visibility of the glory of God on the day of judgment, when God will come to make all things right. And the righteous will contemplate, will see and meditate on the glory of God that is revealed in that moment of judgment. But Jesus doesn't judge. Well, minor point. We also have the Psalms of Solomon, probably written around sometime in the first century, maybe the second, that uses some of the same motifs. So it's out there in the Jewish world that the glory of God is going to be a major element in the end time transformation of things. In John, the eschatological revelation of glory is a reality not in the future, but a reality that takes place on the cross. So as we saw with the notion of resurrection in chapter 11, the notion of eschatological judgment, which we've alluded to already, and the notion of the coming glory of God that transforms all things. All of these eschatological categories are used by the evangelist of the death and resurrection of Christ, the notion of realized eschatology or realizing eschatology is at work here. That is, John is reflecting on what Christians have claimed and making a new package for these claims. Okay, so that is, I think, a useful setup for the Last Supper and the farewell discourses. There's a lot here, and I'm covering a good deal of territory, and I'm sure there'll be questions asked. I'm not going to be able to go into detail and a lot of these things. We'll pick out some important highlights in these passages that I hope will give you a framework for reading and understanding them as you go forward. So first of all, a little bit of an overview of what we get in the Last Supper and the farewell discourses. In terms of structure, I've been big on the notion that John likes diptychs, likes balanced pericopes that interact with one another in interesting ways. There's a bit of a shift that takes place in the second half of the gospel, and John, or the Johannine editors, if we have more than one, seem to begin to favor more of a chiastic or ring composition. That is, a series of episodes where the first somehow corresponds to the last, and they all frame some central episode. This notion of a ring composition is found in ancient rhetoric or applications of modern categories of study of structure to ancient rhetoric. It's there all over the place. It's there in ancient rhetoric because of the ways in which ancient orators had to memorize what they were up to and the speeches that they were going to give. And they organized their speeches by framing them in terms of architectural structures that usually have some sort of arc-like frame and center on things. So it's not surprising that people who are in touch with ancient rhetorical or literary devices get into ring compositions in one way or another, or chiastic compositions. Chiasm is the Greek term coming from the letter chi, has an X, and if you look at the way in which a ring composition can be framed, it looks like part of an X. So what we have here, I think in chapter 13, is a nice little diptych. We have the foot washing at supper scene, followed by discussion about the betrayer, and those two neatly balance one another. Then we have the farewell discourse that begins on the note of glorification. Glory is big throughout these chapters, and the love command. The love command, which is the point at which glory is revealed and is the vehicle through which glory is revealed. And that begins in chapter 13, 31 and following. Then there's a dialogue between Jesus and the disciples that runs from the end of chapter 13 through the end of chapter 14. And in this part of the dialogue, we encounter for the first time the figure of the Paraclete. We're going to have to spend a little bit of time on that figure. And at the end of chapter 14, we have Jesus saying to the disciples, okay, let's go, time's up, which has suggested to lots of people that the farewell discourse originally ended there and was supplemented by the material that follows in chapter 15, chapters 15, 16, and 17. That may be so. But in any case, the addition of the material is by someone who has the same theological bent as the person who's put everything else together and is working with the same set of presuppositions, maybe with a little tweaking. So it could be the same person who has decided he needs to balance something that he said before. In any case, what happens is the creation of a nice ring that focuses on an image, a pair of images, or an image and a command, the image of the true vine and discussion of the love command again. So a diptych right in the center of this ring that's followed by more dialogue with the disciples in chapters 15 and 16, although the dialogue is not quite as intense as it is in chapters 13 and 14, and another comment on the Paraclete and the relationship between these two sets of comments on the Paraclete is one of the things that leads many people to think, oh, maybe we have a new editor or the author rethinking some of his material from before. And then finally, we have the prayer for unity, the so-called high priestly prayer in chapter 17. So that's the overall shape of things. And I think it's useful to keep that in mind as you're reading through this material. The stuff that we're dealing with here in chapters 13 through 17 has different literary connections and evokes different kinds of literary forms. Initially, and in the dialogue materials of the farewell discourse, it invokes the conventions of symposia, that is, accounts of dinner parties and conversations over heady matters that goes back to Plato and Xenophon and continues down through antiquity. Plutarch, roughly contemporary with the fourth gospel, does a symposium. And then they, the category is picked up by early Christians. We have in the third century a bishop named Methodius of Olympus, who does a symposium of virgins, talking about their virginity. Love is a big theme in a lot of these symposia because it's there in the archetype of symposia, Plato's symposia, where the issue on the table is what is love? And all of the people who are engaged in conversation there give a perspective on love from their own professional point of view, be it a philosopher, a dramatist, a doctor, who knows what, or a prophetess who gives the deciding voice to what true love is all about there, Diotima. In any case, there's a convention of having dinner parties where love is on the table and different points are made about what love is. In Plato, it's all about the relationship between man-boy, pederastic love, and the kind of love that Plato wants to advocate, Platonic love, which is creating beauty in the minds or souls of the beloved, different from the loving that goes on in a lot of the other speeches of that symposium. And this goes all the way to Methodius of Olympus, who talks about the love of virgins for virginity and celibacy. So love can be framed in different ways. But love is often a topic of symposia. Another literary form that John is calling upon and using here is the form of a testament. That is what someone says just before he or she departs from life. And some of the same plays on temporal categories that we find in the Last Supper discourse here are also found in testaments. Deuteronomy is in some ways a testament, and the form of testament became very widespread in Jewish literature of the Second Temple period. We have testaments of the 12 patriarchs, testament of Moses, testament of Job, and several others. John 15 and 16 in particular, I think the latter part of this whole business comes closest to the testamentary genre. And then there's at least a connection with a theme that runs through consolation literature. That is literature that largely philosophers write to people who have lost a loved one, to a wife or some other person who has lost a member of the family. And a philosopher will say, relax, it's not the end, or there's a better hope for the person, or we all have this to worry about. Yes, but there's immortality. You know, there are all sorts of ways in which one can offer consolation. But that too is an element of the literary tradition that John is weaving in. So all of these things get combined into the story of the Last Supper and Jesus's last discourse. The Last Supper is a meal before Passover, so not a Passover Seder, can't be, because the Passover lambs are being slain on Good Friday. So it's a different kind of meal from what we're used to seeing in the Synoptic Gospels. And there's no broken bread or wine used as a symbol of blood, all of which are issues that seem to have been dealt with back there in chapter 6. And we talked when we did our analysis of that chapter about how those Eucharistic elements, if we can call them that, work there. And because they're working there, the evangelist doesn't have to worry about them here. He has other things that he wants to put on the table, namely the foot washing, an act which he says is a necessary, says to Peter, Jesus says to Peter, is a necessary condition of fellowship with him. Is this an allusion to some sort of ritual that's a necessary condition for membership in the community? An allusion to baptism? Does foot washing simply serve as a symbol of baptism? Or is it something else? Well, Jesus gives an interpretation of the action and describes the action as an example, a hupodegma, an example of humble service. And that, it would seem, is what it is to be the necessary condition of relationship to God through Christ. The acceptance of humble service as essence of what God is asking one to do. The foot washing then is a very important sign, if you will, in the fullest sense of what sign means for the evangelist. That is, it's something that conveys meaning at a deep level, and one has to push to get that meaning. But at the same time, the meaning is right there if you look at it and see what's going on. This is probably, in fact, a dramatic interpretation of a saying that we find in one form or another elsewhere in the gospel tradition, either the saying about the Son of Man coming to serve and not be served that we get in Mark 10:45, or Luke 22:26 saying the one who serves is greater than the master. And since Jesus has used the master-servant language here, it may well be that that's the form of the saying that's most relevant to the dramatic instantiation of the theme that we get here. The action, in any case, anticipates the command to love that Jesus gives in 13:34, that love command that will reverberate in the later chapters of the farewell discourse. And all of that, the action of Jesus and the love command and its reverberation, provides the interpretation for the coming passion and provides the substance of what the glorification is. That is, the revelation of self-giving love is what the life and death and coming again of Jesus is all about, whenever that coming occurs. And we're going to hear a little bit more about that in a minute. So this chapter is, I think, very important for setting up what John is trying to do in the gospel as a whole, that is, offer an interpretation of the life and death of Christ, focus on the love command that is the essence of the revelation of who God is. After that episode, then we have the discussion of the betrayal, which echoes synoptic materials. We can see how we have a balance here in the Johannine material between stuff that he's getting from other sources and inserting, reshaping a little bit, and stuff that he creates and shapes in a major way. In any case, the betrayal is something that we find in the synoptics, and it's all focused on Judas here. That betrayal is taking place, is signified in terms of the symbol of darkness and light. The dramatic reference to it being night when Judas goes out signals that whole business. And it's interesting that Peter is also involved in the possibility of denial, anticipating what goes on in chapter 18, and his rehabilitation in chapter 21. So when thinking about reactions to Jesus and the way in which different characters exemplify reactions to Jesus, it's important to note, I think, how Peter functions in this text. John does not spend an awful lot of time on notions of reconciliation and forgiveness, as does Luke, but he has this important symbol of it, particularly in Peter. A little bit of comic relief, or maybe not so comic relief, as we're thinking about the foot washing. There are all sorts of portrayals of the foot washing. This is one by an artist, one of whose pieces I've shown before, that is the feeding piece that hangs in the refectory at Yale Divinity School. This piece by Jonica Swanson, another piece with the same kind of technique of layered colors, is a rendition of the foot washing. And there are several that he has, and some are much more conventional, where all of the characters have beards. Here they don't. The only one who has a beard is Jesus. And how many of them are there? There are 13. And are they guys or gals, one might ask? I think John August Swanson wants you to ask that question, and might want you to ask the question about who was there at the Last Supper, and what kind of significance did that have for the future of ministry. In any case, one little interesting take on the Last Supper. Yeah, the foot washing, of course, has become something of a sacramental, to use the technical Catholic term, that is symbolic action, that's not one of the seven divinely ordained sacraments, but it does something similar. Other traditions like the Mennonites certainly make a big deal of the foot washing, and it's become common in Easter celebrations in many of our different denominations these days. Here is Pope Francis doing his version of the foot washing in a field just within the last couple of years. The other thing that happens at the Last Supper here is the first formal appearance of the beloved disciple. He may have been lurking around in some other places earlier on in the gospel, but he's certainly here. And where is he? He's lying in the kolpos, or in the bosom of Jesus, which of course is a typical posture for someone at a symposium and at a Passover Seder. It's one of the questions that's asked at a Passover Seder. Why are we here in this way? Well, because this is a special meal. In any case, this is the way people reclined at banquets in antiquity, at formal dinners. And so that's what John is doing. That's why he's on the kolpos of Jesus. He's at the proper place, right by Jesus, so at the place of honor. So the beloved disciple is right there by Jesus' side, imitating the relationship between the Logos and God that was spoken about in the prologue. Where the divine word that became flesh in Jesus had been in the bosom of the Father, or at the bosom of the Father. Might also echo Luke 16:22, where we hear the story of Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham. Another echo, perhaps, of the Lazarus whom we encountered in chapter 11. In any case, the beloved disciple is here in that position of intimacy. And Peter has to go through him to get to Jesus. So whatever Peter's position in the hierarchy of leadership of the early church, at least in John's rendition of the Last Supper, he's in a secondary position to the beloved disciple, whoever the beloved disciple is or whatever he represents. Keep that in mind as we just look at a couple more pictures of the Last Supper. Here's a more traditional one from the Renaissance. This is Domenico Ghirlandaio from the 15th century. And this kind of scene is often replicated in art, where you have the beloved disciple lying at the bosom of Jesus in a way that made sense to the artist, who didn't understand the practice of reclining a table where everybody is reclining a table in antiquity. So if it says that the beloved disciple is reclining in the bosom of Jesus, he must have had too much to drink or something, or it was too late and he fell asleep. In any case, there he is, lying down on the table. All right, a bit of amusement, perhaps. Interesting that in probably the most famous rendition of the Last Supper, Da Vinci's, which still hangs in Milan, done in the end of the 15th century, John, who is clearly to the our left of Jesus, his right, and is bending over to hear Peter's question. You see Peter's hand under the chin of John the Baptist. Is he hitting, not John the Baptist, John the beloved disciple, is he hitting him in the throat, or is he pointing over to John, to Judas? What's he doing there? Whatever he's doing, this is a rendition of the point where Peter is questioning the beloved disciple about who it is that's going to betray Jesus. and the beloved disciple is there, a young man, handsome, beardless, etc. But he's not lying down on the table, right? Although Da Vinci thought that that was one way to represent the scene. Here's Da Vinci's sketches of the Last Supper. And you can see two versions of the beloved disciple over here. Here you have more or less what you get in the final version, young man, beardless, head tilted over, not quite far as tilted as he is in the other version. Here you have him as pretty much he was represented in the Ghirlandaio painting with his head on the table, out cold, either, you know, had too much to drink or a little too late. And in any case, Da Vinci said, now we got to get the Peter scene in. That's important. Why? Because it might say something about hierarchy, and maybe that's something to be contemplated. Okay, enough of art history. Let's get back to the farewell discourses. And in the first part of the farewell discourse, I'll call it part A, chapters 13 and 14, before the pivot on the vine, we have the dramatic pronouncement that involves the theme of glorification, right? The theme of glorification is all over the place here. Glorification is happening now. And in case you weren't aware of it, it's happening now when Jesus gives the command to love, which he says is a new command. Is it new? No, it's there in the Old Testament. Love your neighbor as yourself. What's new here is love as I am showing you how to love, right? As I've showed you in the hupadegma that I've just given you, and as I will show you in the ultimate hupadegma on the cross, love in that way is what Jesus, I think, is saying in John's version of the love command. So the first round of the Last Supper or the farewell discourse talks about Jesus' departure and his promised return to abide in and with his disciples and his promise of an advocate or paraclete. So let's look at that and go into it just a little bit more in detail. At the beginning of chapter 14, Jesus says he's going away to prepare abodes for the disciples. Monai is the word, which is related to the Greek word for remaining or staying, meno, which is the verbal form. And that's not accidental. We saw the beginning of this play back in chapter 1 and heard it a couple of other times along the way, and here it is in spades. It's all about abiding. But there may be some allusion to contemporary architecture too. This was a period when apartment buildings were being built and multiple unit dwellings were all over the place. And so there may be an allusion to that. In my father's big condo building, there are lots of good condos where you can co-domain, you could live together. Jesus says he's going to return. When? There are all sorts of predictions about the return of Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels, the eschatological discourse of Mark 13, which we talked about in thinking about the Son of Man, has one of those, right? John goes on and says that there's indwelling taking place already, the Father in me and I in him. And so I do what I do because of that relationship that I have with the Father. Note that what we have forming here is yet another chiastic structure, another framing of things. Jesus says in 4:12, I'm leaving, I'm going. And then 4:15, if you love me, keep my commandments. This, in fact, is the condition for abiding. This is how abiding takes place, by hearing and obeying that command. Jesus, having said that he's going, says, but I'm not leaving you orphans, and I will come, repeating things again. There's a lot of repetition in this Last Supper discourse. He's coming back, how? As the Messiah at the end of time? No, he never quite says that, does he? Is he coming back as the paraclete? Maybe, or maybe he's coming in some other way. He reaffirms, as he had already said, that he's in the Father, and that you, disciples, are in me and I'm in you. So there's a mutual indwelling. What does it mean? There's a relationship that has been established by his coming into the world, by his engaging with people in this way and by leaving this command that they love one another as he has loved them. And to make this quite clear, he says, keep my word. And then we, the Father and I, will abide in you. The relationship depends upon your acceptance of this revelation and this willingness to keep this command. The notion that Jesus is somehow abiding in the hearts and minds of people who accept his teaching is not new. We have that in a slightly different form in Paul. In Galatians 2, I live now, not I, but Christ lives in me. So John is not inventing something. He's given a new narrative expression to something that was there on the lips of many early Christian teachers. So Jesus says, I will go and will come again. How? In the life of disciples. John, in other words, adapts eschatological hope, which comes to be realized now in the relationship that people have to God through Christ, through the example that they follow. Briefly on the Paraclete, we have, and then I think I'm going to call a halt to it there and take some questions. Might pick up on the final prayer of Jesus next time. We have these two versions of a reference to the Paraclete. Jesus says in chapter 14, verse 16, I'll send another advocate. Parakletos is means called to one side, advocatus, called in. And like advocate, Paraclete is a legal technical term for someone who was called in as a legal advisor or an advisor who provides other kinds of advice or consolation. Jesus says this is the Spirit of truth. So we're not talking about some other human being. We're talking about the pneuma, the Spirit. And what he will do will be to teach and remind. And what we have here, I think, is quite clearly just an interpretation of early Christian teaching on the Spirit that's a presence in the community. More prominent in John than in the Synoptics, extremely important in Paul, where Christ, the new Adam, is the Spirit, or where the Lord is the Spirit in 2 Corinthians, and quite prominent too in Luke, both in the Gospel and particularly in Acts, where the Spirit is in fact an actor, a player in the drama, who moves things along and determines how things are going to go. So the personification of the Spirit of God, which is an Old Testament term widely used for God's presence and power in the world. The personification of that notion is something that's been there. It's in early Christian language, and John uses it here, labeling it the Paraclete. The Paraclete part two comes up in chapter 15. Again, the Spirit of truth, picking up the language of verse 14, who bears witness. We have new functions accorded to the Spirit, picking up themes that are prominent in John, and bearing witness is one of those. And the Spirit also has judgmental themes. So the legal dimensions of Paraclete language come to bear in John 16, 8, because the Paraclete will convict the world. As a prophetic judge, this is an edgier version, if you will, of the Paraclete than what we had earlier on. And he's also a teacher who will teach in all truth. So what does the Paraclete do? The Paraclete does the things that the Spirit was supposed to do in all of these other texts. He teaches, he leads, he provides inspiration for prophecy that involves judgment on the contemporary scene. And here, Jesus is in some ways an intermediary between the Father and the Spirit, but they're all somehow united. There's, if you will, kind of proto-Trinitarian doctrine going on here, but nothing quite like proto-Trinitarian, not like Trinitarian doctrine of late antiquity. Okay, we're at 7:50, and there's more to be said about the vine and the branches, which is at the center of the discourse. And the wrap up, which is what happens in the final prayer of Jesus in chapter 17. But I think I'm going to call a halt here, and perhaps I'll say a little bit more about those pericopes next time.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for session 6.